Hey, this is Billy Strings, and you're listening to Walking the Floor.
I'm walking the floor over you.
Walking the floor.
I'm walking the floor.
Walking the floor over you.
Hola, senores and senoritas. This is Chris Shiflett, and you are listening to Walking the Floor. America and Beyond's favorite podcast. You know it's true. You know, in 2020, I gotta tell you, I'm getting pretty sick of saying in every one of these little podcast rambles that this has been the weirdest week ever. Because, you know, this year, that's like every week is stranger than the last one. But this one might really take the cake. Let's go through it. Trump gets corona, goes into the hospital, media speculation goes wild, then he leaves the hospital, continuing to expose everyone around him, like the Secret Service and the White House staff, to corona. And as I record this, it's only Tuesday. So by the time this thing posts on Monday, it's anybody's guess how this week winds up. But I think this might take the cake, man. This might be the weirdest, strangest week of all. Thank goodness. Well, I was going to say thank goodness we only have a month left, but who really knows how much more of this shit we got left? This could go on forever, whatever forever means. On the bright side, there's always a bright side. And on the bright side, there has been lots and lots of surf this week. And Arsenal did some pretty good business in the transfer market, if I do say so myself. And I'm feeling pretty good about the season that just started. And that's it, kids. You gotta look for the silver linings, man. You gotta look for the silver lining somewhere. That's my silver lining for this week. Okay, let's talk about Zounds.com. Did you know that Zounds.com has been around since 1996? That's right. They started way, way back when as a small little retail shop and have since grown to become one of the biggest and bestest online musical instrument retailers on earth, baby. So get on over to Zounds.com where you're always going to get the best deals and the best shipping and the best of everything at Zounds.com. All right, let's get to today's interview. So Billy Strings is a young flat pick and ripper who grew up on bluegrass and heavy metal and plays like a young man possessed. I remember the first time I saw some footage of him online or something, I just thought, Jesus, who is this kid? How'd he get so good so young? He's like baby-faced kid up there just ripping on an acoustic, which is really hard, man. All you guitar players know that's the hardest way to do it. And he's like lightning fast, like Malmsteen fast. So he talks about that in this interview, you know, how he grew up in Michigan, learned to play guitar, playing bluegrass with his dad and his dad's friends, and then discovered like Jimi Hendrix and metal and stuff and kind of went down that road later on. If you listen all the way through to the end, he even shows me a couple of hot licks that I got to sit down and learn now. After I listened back to this interview yesterday, I actually went home and threw that Dust in a Baggy song in my amazing slower downer. So I could figure out the guitar solo in it, and it's crazy. I got it pretty good about half speed. So I'm gonna be working with my metronome trying to get that thing up to full speed, but I don't know. Pretty damn hard. Alright, this is Billy Strings on Walking the Floor.
Until it goes down. Had enough to push us over.
I guess first off, you know, for a guy that tours as much as you have over the years, how are you spending this time at home? How are you adapting to life at home?
Well, at the beginning of the, you know, quarantine, I basically started tinkering on I got a couple old cars that I like to mess with. I got a couple Chevelles, and one of them's kind of really nice, but the other one's like a project car. Mm. So that's been really fun and like a zen thing, you know.
Right.
Just fixing it up. I mean, I'm no master mechanic or anything, but I'm just like having fun tinkering on that stuff. And then I went on this camping trip with a couple of our close friends and neighbors, and we went kayaking and we like took some acid on the river and floated down. And had a great day, and I brought my fishing poles, and I realized that, holy shit, like, I can go fishing.
Acid.
Yeah. And that was a little weird, honestly, because I caught a fish.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I caught a couple fish, but one fish was too little, and he, like, kind of fucked himself up on the hook. And, I mean, it was my fault, though, and I was just, like, devastated.
What does that fish look like when you're tripping your balls off and you pull that thing out? Because, like, fishing can be kind of shocking. You never know what's going to be on the end of that pole anyway. How was that?
Beautiful, except for I hurt the little guy.
Oh, yeah.
Well, it just, like, and that's what was weird, because, you know, when you're tripping, you're so, like, sensitive and kind of,
yeah.
But I, you know, this really little bass come up and hit my big old crankbait, and one of the hooks got caught in his side, and I'm sitting there trying to get the hook out of him, and I finally got it out, and he flopped into the water, and I know he kind of ripped his little side of his scales up a little bit, and I just was like, fuck, like, that's not why I'm out here to, like, just fuck these fish up, you know? I mean, I don't know. And that's so, it threw my little trip off for like 10 minutes, and then I just kept paddling and eventually started fishing again and had a great day. But anyways, that whole thing started, like, fishing has been one of my things, you know, kind of just like music, or not as much as music, but me and my dad used to, you know, go fishing a bit when I was a kid too. So it's one of them things that, because I was on the road so much, and, you know, I mean, I've moved to Nashville like probably 5 years ago or more, and I, you know, up until recently, I haven't went fishing at all. I mean, I've my stuff's been in Nashville for about 5 years, but I've only lived here for about two during that time.
Right. Oh, I'm so glad to hear you say that, because I've been going down the fishing rabbit hole too, and I've fished on and off, you know, here and there. I'm a total novice. Like, I don't know what the fuck I'm doing, you know? Like, I take my kids fishing every now and again. We fish off the beach. We're out here in California. Man, we just fish for little perch and stuff. But in this lockdown, I've been kind of like going down that rabbit hole, and I actually just, you know how it is, like, I got my little setup and I'm catching perch, and then I'm kind of like, I think I want to get a bigger setup and try to get something bigger. So I kind of was doing that. And then I started taking my stand-up paddleboard out to the kelp beds and trying to fish out there. And then just last week I bought a fishing kayak, and I've been trying to figure that thing out. And kind of like your story, hooking up that little fish that made you feel bad. Dude, my second time fishing that, the kelp beds, not too far from where I live, I hooked up a fucking seal the other day.
Oh my God.
Oh my God. Talk about feeling like shit. Like, that was like the last thing I wanted, you know what I mean? And it went from like, and I'm out there with my buddy, and it went from like my poles like bent into the water. I'm going, oh my God, there's a fucking trophy. Like, I don't know what is on the, I'm thinking I got a big fucking white bass or something. Finally, I get it up to where I could, like, the fluorocarbon is, I can see it. So I know it's close, you know? And all of a sudden I just see a fucking seal swim under my kayak. And right then he breaks the line. And in that moment, I'm not kidding, dude, I could see my swim bait in his mouth. I felt like it went from like the greatest moment of all time to like, oh my God, I'm fucking up nature right now so bad.
Yeah. And you just feel like an idiot because, yeah, it's just like, man, that's not why I'm out here. Like,
I think the ocean paid me back right after that. I tried to navigate that thing into the beach and just dumped it, flipped it right over and fucking lost my fishing pole right then. Boom.
Yeah.
Payback.
Yeah, it must be hard to, like, unless you have, like, a really, like, probably big kayak or something to, if the, you know, I like, float on little creeks and streams and lakes and stuff, but
yeah.
ocean fishing on a kayak would be pretty gnarly.
I have quickly figured out it's the getting in and the getting out that's the hard part. Once you're out there, it's, you know, you're just cruising. Yeah. But I get it now why guys launch off a boat launch in a harbor. I think I'm gonna start to do that myself. Yeah. I've had some incredible disasters just in the short time, in the less than a week that I've had that fucking thing. But anyway, that I love that stuff because I love talking to people about, you know, I'm always interviewing musicians, and I'm a musician myself, and obviously that's like, you know, the the biggest part of our lives besides family and whatever. But I'm always curious to hear what people do besides that in their spare time. You know, I just get so sick of talking about like guitar and stuff that it's always fun to hear.
Yeah. And I think that like you said, during this time, you know, all of us that like are always on the road or just grinding and always with the guitar in our hands, you know, we're finally like, yeah, I mean, for me, when I was always on the road, like for months and months at a time, you know, and playing 200 gigs a year for years and years or whatever, like I was always thinking like, man, what would it be like to just be at the same, you know, sleep in my bed every night and have a dog and, you know, and like watch the same show like every night or whatever. You know?
Just be like, well, you can do that from tour. Come on, that's what Netflix is for.
Yeah, I guess. But by the time I get back to my hotel room, I'm already so like, it's like, okay, it's like 3 a.m. You got to get up at 9. You better go to sleep. You know.
That's the funny thing, man. Managing, like, as I'm considerably older than you, and now when I go out on like my, when I do my solo tours and I'm touring in a van and I've got that kind of schedule where you're doing 6 nights a week or whatever, that's like a hard part of it, is like managing to get enough sleep, just managing my sleep. Cause the show, it's like, you're kind of revved up. It's not like you can just go jump in bed and like, okay, lights out.
Right. Yeah. That's the other thing, is just coming down from that, because we were on stage not long ago. So like, especially if your room's just like close to the venue, what we always, you know, used to have to do was, you know, we'd play the gig and then we tear down all our shit and throw it in the van. And then by the time we're out of there, like I said, it's you know, it's probably midnight or at 1 at least. And then we still got to drive a couple hours because we got to load in at 2 tomorrow. And we got, you know, 5 or 6 hours to cover here. And it's like, we don't want to get up at 7 o'clock in the morning, do we? Or you know,
that is the worst part of the van tour, what you're just describing. It's that when you're like, well, let's just put a couple hours dent into this drive tonight. And then you get like an hour into it and you're like, ah, fuck, we're doing it. Why'd we do it?
Yeah, totally. It's, you know, there's been some, definitely some brutal moments, but it's all worth it. It's been all worth it, you know.
Well, okay, so how did your streaming tour go? Tell me about that. What was that all about?
It went surprisingly well, in my opinion. Like, I didn't really know what to expect. You know, I was like, are we going to be able to jam? Like, you know, like,
without people there to feed off?
Yeah. Like, that's so much of our thing, you know. Like, so much of our, or at least I feel that, the audience really charges us to play better, you know? And I've often felt that like we can only play as good as the crowd that night, you know, like
they have to figure out a way. Maybe there's a simple workaround with this, but somebody has to figure out a way to be able to like get the feed off everybody's laptop that's watching it. So you can hear the applause or the response or whatever, you know what I mean?
You couldn't hear the applause, but when we played at the Brooklyn Bowl here in Nashville, it's like a brand new Brooklyn Bowl. But they had like these projectors on the walls, and there's this thing called, you know, it's like where you can be in the stream or whatever. And so all these people, you could, while we're playing, I could look over and see on the wall on these projectors and see people dancing around their living room with their fucking cat.
Oh, that's nice. Whatever.
And like occasionally you'd see like a little dog or something. And so yeah, that really did, like, it boosted our morale, you know?
So all you need on top of that is like just have canned applause noise from like Live Aid, and just have your sound man kind of like push it up every now and again when a song ends, and then boom, that's like a show.
Totally. Yeah, we got this. Simulation. You know, you got to reinvent the wheel or whatever.
So, like, is that something that you're going to do again? I know you did a bunch of shows, like, in what, like, about a month's time, something like that?
Yeah, who knows? You know, I mean, I don't know if we'll do that or try something else. Or I think we're going to do a couple of these, like, drive-in gigs.
How's that work?
Well, I think it's supposed to work. Like, everybody comes in and parks their car and sort of socially distances and wears masks and hangs out. But, you know, I've heard a couple, you know, like I heard about one in New York that kind of went to shit when everybody didn't really follow the rules, you know, and they all just kind of went up on the rail. And it was like, dude, you guys, that's not what's happening here. We got to. And so I think they, like all the fans, fucked it over for even the band that was supposed to play there like the next week or whatever because of you know, the government was like, no, see, it's not working. We can't be doing this shit. So I don't know. Hopefully, I think our fans would be cool enough to be chill and socially distance and stuff. But you never know. Sometimes our shit gets crazy too. But you know, for the most part, I think people would be respectful enough to understand that, you know?
Sure. I mean, it seems like the type of thing that will work for some bands, but it's hard to imagine, like, you know, a Slayer gig with everybody socially distancing or what, you know what I mean? Like, or I mean, for that matter, a Foo Fighter gig, you know what I mean? It's like, it's hard to imagine what that would be like. You, as musicians, we all spend our lives like dreading playing a half empty room. And then now it's like, that might be the best thing we can do for a while.
So that was like what I was kind of scared about during the streaming tour thing. But you got to think, man, I went from living in a bus or a van or a wherever, being on stage at soundcheck with these other three other dudes for a long time, and all of a sudden it's like I don't see them anymore. You know, like these guys are like, you know, my family, like the dudes that I pick with, you know, they're,
are they people like, are these guys, like the guys in your band, are they dudes that like you came up with in Michigan, like when you were younger, or are these folks you found in Nashville? Cause I was wondering about that. Like, cause you're such a ripper and the style of music you play requires a pretty high level of musicianship. So it occurred to me, like, were there people around you growing up that could keep up with you?
Yeah, my dad, you know, is a badass, man. That's how I got my start. My dad is an incredible guitar player. So when I was little, I just played rhythm. I didn't play any lead for the longest time. And, you know, when I was a little kid, 6, 7, 8, 9 years old, I played rhythm guitar and my dad would play all the leads and stuff. And I learned all these tunes, you know, Long Journey Home, and Beaumont Rag and Salt Creek and Big Mon and, you know, just all these old Stanley Brothers and Bill Monroe and Doc Watson stuff.
Right.
And I would just follow along. And I developed like an ear for it, you know, like early on, just hearing all them songs and figuring out how the harmonies work together and stuff, just hearing it, like hearing my dad sing with his friend Brad would sing tenor. And I'm just being a little kid thinking like, man, okay, Brad's singing higher and they're not singing the same note. And sometimes they, when they move, Brad stays right where he's at. But, you know, so in just kind of listening to stuff like that, and bluegrass harmony is it's like there's a peculiar kind of thing about it. You know, the vocal, like the way that the harmonies kind of work. And
sure.
It's got like a lonesome sound, you know?
And
I heard
lonesome.
That, yeah, I heard that as a kid and I just kind of latched onto it and always kind of, you know, ended up picking with my dad and just learning by ear and stuff and played rhythm for a long time. So I think that really like helped with my foundation as far as playing, is that I played rhythm for so long. And then eventually one day, you know, what happened actually is he got me like an electric guitar. He got me a little red Strat and a pig nose amp.
Right.
For Christmas. I was like 11. And that's when I got into Hendrix and Zeppelin and Black Sabbath and started learning how to do like blues guitar solos and stuff. Those were the first kind of leads that I was actually taking.
Oh, really? Before that's interesting, because listening to you play, like, I do hear shades of like Jimmy Page in there, you know?
Yeah, I mean, those were the first kind of like solos that I was trying to attempt for some reason. And then, you know, I went through a phase in high school where it started off with that electric guitar and I got into Black Sabbath, and then you know, there was a while in middle school where I didn't necessarily go around telling everybody I played bluegrass. You know, it was like right. something that I did with my dad.
So right.
I wasn't embarrassed about it, but it was like, I wasn't like bragging about it either. You know, it was kind of
yeah,
like,
sure.
I just kept it, you know, it was like something I did with my dad.
Sure.
And so I just wanted to play music with people that were my age. You know, all my life I had played music and a lot of good music. I've been to a lot of good, you know, bluegrass jam sessions coming up, but I was always,
where'd you grow up? Like in Michigan, where'd you grow up?
Ionia.
And is there like a bluegrass scene up around there?
No.
Like how was your dad into it? And how did you went to a lot of bluegrass jams and stuff, but like, where were those?
Well, there was like a little bluegrass festival called Charlotte Bluegrass Festival. And then there was one over in Lowell called Fall Fest, which was like WMBMA, like the West Michigan Bluegrass Music Association. I'm talking little festivals, you know, 300-400 people max.
Right.
And every year I watched them thin out, you know, especially the Fall Fest. It was like back when I was a kid and we used to go there, we would be picking all night out at somebody's camper. We would never even make it to the main stage to see the acts. We would just be out there
really?
Playing. Hell yeah, dude. I mean, that's like what it was like at a bluegrass festival when I first started going to them. It was like, I never made it to the stage to see the bands to play. I went there to pick with people,
wow.
you know, that's why. And that's why not only me, I mean, there was hundreds of people just like me that just grabbed their banjo and head off to the bluegrass festival and just walk around until they hear a good jam and, hey guys, can I join in? And
right.
fuck yeah, dude. Next thing you know, you're sitting there playing music with five dudes who you've never met, but you know all the same tunes, so you can play like a band that's rehearsed.
Right.
You know,
okay,
and
so is that sort of your entry into performing live?
No, I think I learned how to perform in a metal band. I didn't really play many like live gigs. Man, when I played bluegrass, it was like, you know, growing up when I was playing with my dad and stuff, we played maybe just a couple gigs here and there. It was mostly the only time I played live, like I was a little kid and there was a VFW hall where it was like, all it was like the bingo scene,
right?
Like it was like a bunch of old folks and it was at the old VFW hall, and every first of the month or whatever they would have this thing called the Maple River Strummers, and everybody would get together and you know, Martha would have her hammer dulcimer and Larry would bring his old Gibson guitar and you know, everybody would come together and sing Hank Williams and Johnny Cash songs and everything. And when I was a little kid, we used to go there and play. And that was kind of fun. And so that, you know, I got up in front of that old bingo crowd a couple times when I was a little kid like that. And one time we played this gig at like a, I don't know, somebody maybe seen us play there and asked my mom, hey, can we hire him to play for $200? And my mom was like, man, how about him and his dad and Uncle Brad, and then they can split all the money. She didn't want me to, you know, she didn't want it to go to my head.
Like sure.
to think that I could, wow, $200, you know? So then we split the money or whatever. And that was like my first gig. I was probably like 8 years old or something.
Nice.
You know, but then, after that, you know, it was really only, didn't really play out live much. It was like I said, at my house, in the bedroom with my dad or out on the back deck or whatever. Or there was this place called Barkus Park, which it's fucking nuts, dude. Like shit got weird there for a while. Like when I grew up in Ionia, it's rural America. It's small town America. There's like at that time, there was a lot of meth and shit.
Right.
And like my, you know, a lot of people I know like were involved in it, and I, you know, I dabbled with it and shit. Like it was
like your song Dust in a Baggie, right? Is that where that comes from?
That's about someone I know.
Right. Oh, okay.
Totally. I mean, it's a true story. But there's this place called Barkas Park, and it was right on the Stony Creek. And that's where, like, my dad's friend Brad lived, Brad Lasko. And we used to hang out and play music down there all the time, like around the campfire. And there was a creek. We'd be fishing all night playing music. I mean, I was a little kid, and I wouldn't get home till, you know, 2 or 3 in the morning, because I'd be out there hanging, sitting on the cooler playing bluegrass with them guys all night, you know. I remember I used to come home and my face would be like black from the soot from sitting so close to the fire. You know, I've never experienced that since, but I remember that, you know. And it was awesome. Like, everybody was partying, and I was just a little kid, and it was just like I said, I was always around a bunch of older people. So then when I got to middle school and stuff, I was like, man, I want to play music with, like, people that are my age. Like, you know, I'm like a young, like, skater kid or whatever. Like,
yeah.
Just like, I don't want to play with, like, all these old people anymore, you know. So right, the only shit that was going on was this metal. And there was one little place in town at a VFW hall, which is kind of the only, like, kind of venues that were around or something in our town, you know, besides, like, that was pretty much it. But it was a small town, you know?
Yeah.
But I started going to these metal shows, these really underground shows, you know, and at first I hated it. You know, I'm used to less.
Now, like, when you say metal, are we talking like Cookie Monster metal, like all the roar, 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 and all super saturated guitars and all that stuff?
Yeah. Oh,
see,
yeah.
I read that about you, that you spent some time in that world, but, like, it doesn't seem to have fucked up your guitar playing style. Because, like, you know, as somebody that grew up on, you know, rock music and heavy metal and stuff, like modern heavy metal, to me, to my ear, and I don't want to offend anybody, like, kind of lost the plot after the 80s, you know what I mean? And like, it just, it's like oversaturated and too perfect, and it just doesn't have the soul. Like, I know it may sound ridiculous to people listening, but, like, when I hear, like, my old Rainbow records or something, there's a lot of soul in those records in a funny way. You know, you can hear the air in them or something, you know what I mean? There's, like, warts and stuff. And I feel like, you know, it's not just modern metal, but modern music in general. But anyway, so I don't hear, like, the residue of that in what you do.
Yeah. I think maybe it comes across more in the live show, or, you know, sometimes I might use, like, a little, like this thing in one of my songs. Like, that's not a very bluegrass interval that, you know. So I think, like, little shit like that comes from, you know, playing metal. And also the way that, like, we used to play on stage, I mean, God, we used to spit on people and kick people and jump into the audience and just, like, fight with each other on stage and kick each other and, you know, and jump.
Did you try that at a bluegrass festival where people are like, stop, don't spit on us?
No, especially nowadays.
you mentioned that, like, when you were a kid, you're playing some of these bluegrass festivals that, you know, would have 300, 400 people or so, and then you kind of alluded to it kind of waning over the years, but has there been an uptick in popularity in the years since?
Well, it's strange because all the while the festivals that I was going to are kind of waning, which are the traditional bluegrass festivals.
Okay.
Where, you know, it's a traditional bluegrass festival. You got local bands playing Bill Monroe music into microphones, and there's a raffle and, you know, that kind of thing.
Sure.
During that same time, there was, like, this, you know, leftover salmon, Green Sky Bluegrass, Infamous String Dusters, String Cheese Incident, this whole other, like, kind of hippie bluegrass thing going on.
Is that the new grass? Is that what that genre is?
Sort of, you know, a lot of people call it jam grass or whatever nowadays, but I think it started maybe with Newgrass Revival. It didn't really, there's always been like a, it's basically bluegrass on weed, man.
What were the original bluegrassers on? Like whiskey and methamphetamine? Like what were, you know? Moonshine, right, of course.
Yeah, moonshine and misogyny.
If that's not an album title already, dude, that you need to make that into something.
Yeah, I'd alienate all my fans.
Well, I didn't say it has to be pro misogyny. It could just be a story.
Yeah, well, that's the funny thing is I write a song like Dust in a Baggie. You know, that's a song about a guy who, you know, really fucked up his life and ended up in prison. And he's sitting in there thinking, wow, this sucks. I really fucked up. And, you know, what the traditional folks hear when they hear that is, oh, he just writes a song singing about meth. You know, and it's like, well, did you listen to the story?
It's interesting, though, because it is sort of in that tradition in bluegrass and a lot of country music of, like, murder ballads and, like, sort of heavy subject matter and, you know, murdering your fiance. Well, all that stuff, you know, like, it's sort of, to me, it reads like a modern version of that, but sort of still in the tradition.
This is, like, yeah, it's the exact same thing, except for I just used something that I was used to instead of moonshine or whatever. You know, my dad's not a coal miner. I grew up in Ionia, you know, a little prison town.
Right.
And so that's what I knew about. I mean, I wrote that song when I was like 19 or 18 or 19 or something, and I was at work. I was working at a hotel, and I just scribbled it down. And it was actually about this fella that I knew who, you know, went to prison and then got out. Next thing you know, he went right back for, talking less than a quarter of a gram, like, just dust in the bottom of a baggie, sent him back for like 20 years or something. It's like, man, and it sucked because when he got out, I was like, man, you're out. You've been in there for like 5 years or something. Like, you're out. I'm so proud of you. Like, let's get your life back on track, you know? And it was like a month or two later, he was gone back. So it's like, I don't know. One day the inspiration just struck to write that song, and I just wrote it, you know?
It's funny, you know, so there are certain types of music that sort of seem to attract a sort of almost like a puritanical fan base. And I think bluegrass gets a lot of that, you know, and it's funny. Like, I always kind of trip on that because it seems like the people that a lot of those folks are celebrating were kind of radical in their era, pushing boundaries in their era. You know what I mean? But like, but then there's like this thing like, well, hold on, you can't do that.
Right. Yeah, I don't know. That's the whole thing. I mean, Bill Monroe himself was like, if you think about bluegrass music in the first place, it was like, at the time, really fast, modern, technical music that was a musical goulash of, you know, like cowboy Western guitar and mandolin and Irish and Scottish fiddle tunes and,
right.
You know, like the blues. Black music is deeply embedded in bluegrass. Like, you know, bluegrass, the word blue is in there because of the blues. I mean, that's the whole point, like, of bluegrass is it's lonesome. And it uses those scales. I mean, Bill kind of put that in his music. He, like I said, it's like a musical goulash. And that is so inventive and creative and kind of, you know, all of that in its own way. Like, I think, I don't know. I just think a lot of the bands that are going these days that are just kind of doing their own thing and trying creative things with the banjo and mandolin and bass, you know, like Punch Brothers and, you know, bands like that are just totally pushing the boundaries of like what can even be done with these five instruments or whatever. That's so cool. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about your songwriting because it kind of ties into the subject matter. Like, how do you? I'm always amazed by people that can take sort of traditional, structures and chord progressions and melodies and stuff, and then twist them into something new. So, how do you? Cause I feel like a lot of your music has like it sounds classic, but it's your thing. And how do you approach your songwriting?
I mean, I don't know. I try to just approach it honestly. Like I try to write about stuff that I either try to write about stuff that I care about and that means something to me and that I feel enough passion about to, you know, write a couple pages full of words about, or I try to write about nothing or anything. And I just try to like get out of my own way and almost just like let the pen go and just like kind of just like, who cares if it, like, sometimes, like, I don't sit there and even want, like, I don't even know what it means, you know? Just kind of,
you edit it down later?
Yeah, I mean, I think all of that, sometimes it's just an exercise, you know? And I might even use just bits and pieces of something that I wrote down. And, you know, I might write something down to a different melody and then realize later, oh, these words that I used to sing with this melody could work on this song that I'm working on. Next thing you know, I got two half songs and I figured out how to put them together. And it's like, oh, shit, you know. Just I really try to do anything that I can do to get a song done. And, you know, usually that's not enough.
Well, how has living in Nashville shaped your songwriting and you know, just being around all those incredible musicians and all those incredible writers? Have you, like, has that been an influence on you?
Yeah. I mean, when I first moved here, that's when I actually first started like co-writing with anybody.
Mm.
Because as soon as I got here, I realized that's what everybody was doing.
Right.
And he was like, oh shit. Everybody's like, hey, let's get together and pen a tune. Oh shit. Maybe I should ask somebody if they want to write. So, you know, I wrote a couple songs with like a couple different friends of mine, and that was, yeah, it's really cool because, you know, maybe a lot of stuff that I would get stuck on and only stuck because I think it's not good enough or something, or I think it's just terrible. And then if somebody else is there saying, oh yeah, that's great. I'm like, oh really? Like, all right, we can move on, you know, sweet. And yeah, so not only that, but then like having somebody else's total, you know, their whole insight and input into like a creative piece, you know, it's like really interesting sometimes what somebody else will come up with that you would have never thought of.
I mean, do you have like have you sort of cultivated some relationships with songwriters there that are, do you have like a group of people that you work with regularly?
No, I've only worked with like, there's my friend, John Weisberger, who, like, he's, you know, he's a bluegrass guy. So we know the same language.
Right.
Lyrically. Like, we grew up on all the same Stanley Brothers songs and all that. You know, if I would listen to what mom and dad said, I would not be here today. And they call me by a number, not a name. And, you know, just all of those, you know, little things come to mind, and it's almost like an ancient like way of trying to write down lyrics or something. Like if you think of like the Carter family lyrics or like even Monroe lyrics and stuff like that, sometimes, I mean, Monroe would write shit like come hither to go yonder,
right?
You know, like weird.
Well, it's funny, man. Like I went through my own kind of like journey as a songwriter with a similar thing where, you know, there was a point in my life where I started really going down the, like getting into like honky tonk music and a lot of like Buck Owens and Merle Haggard and a lot of the West Coast stuff or whatever. And I started, and I like, I wanted to write songs like that, but it wasn't really what I was steeped in. And my first attempts at it were sort of like trying to write in their language, but that's like a different language. It's like the language of the 50s and 60s, as opposed to like maybe bluegrass is the language of the traditional stuff, maybe the language of the 30s or something, but it's like, it's not the language we speak now, you know what I mean? And I tried, and I wrote all these songs that were just, I was like, why is this so shitty? And I realized like, wait, I'm trying to write this like as Buck Owens or something instead of as myself, you know?
Right. Now, if you just like use the music and then write about something that you really know about or that you've been through or something, and you know, then I think it can happen. But also if you like, let's see, you're trying to, you know, write music like that sounds old school, you know, and writing lyrics about something that's, you know, new or modern, it just would not work if you're just trying to write, you know, stuff that, like I said earlier, it's like my dad wasn't a coal miner. I'm not, like, I don't know that era, but I know that, like, language from, like, listening to all those tunes or whatever, you know, like, growing up just listening to bluegrass, I think you, like, you just hear all the same kind of stuff almost regurgitated in a way.
Right.
Like, you know, like in the murder ballads and then all this, you know, it's like there's a, every song is different, but there's something so similar about it. Tapping into that. What is that? You know?
Right.
Yeah, it's fun, but it's been fun, like writing and working with people on that.
Well, like going back to your earlier years, like when did you sort of become the version that we know? You know, when did you become have you always sort of gone at it as a solo artist?
No,
I know you had did some stuff earlier with what was the guy's name? Don
Julian.
Right, and then also David Grisman, right?
Oh, well, that was maybe just a short stint. That was
Really?
Yeah, a few gigs. I mean, David is a friend of mine and one of my heroes.
Right.
But yeah, I only played with him for like a short span of gigs.
Okay. I didn't know if he was sort of like the bridge for you between like bluegrass and the Grateful Dead or something. You know what I mean? Like as far as like influence wise.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's how I learned about the Dead was through David. I mean, when I was a little kid, my dad showed me David Grisman, and then I learned about, you know, Jerry and Olden in the Way and stuff, and that's how I got into the Grateful Dead. And being a bluegrass guy, at first it didn't really strike me as, you know, because in like bluegrass, what, even when I was a little kid, what I was always so struck by is the technical proficiency and the way that the instruments sound, you know.
Absolutely. And so it's the shred of country. It's like, yeah, the Yngwie Malmsteen of country, you know.
It's
but it's like these old dudes in suits with cowboy hats. It's so crazy. So
badass. Yeah.
Yeah.
Gangster as fuck, bro.
Okay. They're like, seriously, they're like the country pimps. It's nuts.
Yeah.
The big,
yeah,
rings and all that. It's fucking crazy.
It's
like,
so
because I love bluegrass, but I don't know it, and I can't play it for shit. And every now and again, I try to like watch somebody on YouTube do a fucking lick and try to pick it up, but it's so hard. And I always found myself thinking, like, there's got to be a fucking trick to that. What am I missing? Like, what am I missing here to enables these guys? Like, why the fuck can these old men at these festivals play this shit so fast, and I can't get anywhere near it?
Probably because, you know, they learned it from their dad or their grandpa when they were just a little shit. And like, that's always been their trade, you know?
Right.
And it's like a niche little thing. It's like, you know, like I said about the bluegrass festivals I used to go to, like, they're not big. They're never going to be like mainstream musicians.
Right.
You don't really hear about them. A lot of times they're only local to the little area, the little holler that they're in.
Right.
And it's like, oh yeah, you know, old man up on the hill, he fucking plays the shit out of the fiddle. We all love to hear him play, you know,
right.
But he's not going to be like, you know, on the Opry or anything. He's just a local dude.
It seems like the learning curve would be so steep to go from like hanging out on the cooler with your buddies jamming tunes to like being in one of those bands that, like, it just seems like everybody in them is so proficient at their instrument. You know, like it seems like that would be a big leap.
I think that's the thing that always turned me on about bluegrass, is that there's nothing to, you know, I don't want to say hide behind to sound, you know, not to sound like,
there's no gain to hide behind. There's no volume to hide behind. I mean, that's, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. And like a lot of, you know, the traditional bluegrass bands, they just play into mics. I mean, you show up with your banjo and you just play into the SM57 that's there or whatever, you know. You don't,
right.
You don't have your own front of house engineer, really. You don't have, like, I mean, I guess the professional bands probably really do. They have somebody that has them dialed in.
Right.
But,
right.
Well, you know, the festivals, a lot of times, like, well, I, you know, I I got here at 7 this morning. I rang out these 57s and 58s. I don't know why you just wouldn't want to play into them. Right. You know?
The ultimate throw and go.
Yeah, dude, totally. And you just you work the mics. Like you said, there's no gain or all of your tone is in your pick.
Right.
Or your finger picks or your bow or your fingers or whatever you're playing. And so it's so organic, you know. There's nothing going on from the banjo to the microphone.
Right.
It's just straight fucking banjo in your face. And when I remember the first time I heard that, dude, at Charlotte Bluegrass Festival, like I was a little kid. I was walking through, you know, what I thought we were at, like the fair or something, you know, and I was like holding my mom's hand, walking through this big crowd of people. And all of a sudden I saw these guys walking through with, like you said, with suits and fucking cowboy hats and banjo cases and shit. And all of a sudden, dude, I heard the PA light up and, you know, fiddle, banjo, three-part harmonies, fucking bluegrass coming through the PA. Now, I have heard bluegrass. I've heard it on records. I heard my dad playing it. I never heard it on a PA like that. And right. It was like, holy fuck. And I've never seen the guys all dressed up to the nines playing it with gold-plated banjos and shit. And I was a little kid, man. And I swear in that moment, it was like when I, you know, it was like when a little kid sees the fire truck and was like, dude, right. I'm going to fucking do that when I grow up.
Right, like, right, right.
I was like, when I grow up, I'm going to fucking be in a bluegrass band, dude. That's, you know, like, that's what I'm going to do. I even have this, like, old little thing that I drew in, like, kindergarten that says exactly that. It's like a dude that plays the banjo. And it was, like, in one of those little books that you make in kindergarten. And, you know, right. my teacher, you know, like, would answer the questions. Like, when I grow up, I want to be a bluegrass player. And I drew a little dude with a banjo, you know. And so it's, like, I always like to look at that because it, I mean, it almost makes me, like, it makes me really happy, you know, thinking about my little self, my little 6-year-old or 5-year-old self drawing that little banjo guy being like, wow, bluegrass is cool. Because of my dad. And then like growing up and, you know, being able to actually do that. It's like, wow, this is my dream. You know, this was my dream even when I was a little tiny kid. And somehow I've, you know, got there.
I mean, so. Coming up like that, the way that you describe these festivals, like it must feel really good where you're at now to be on, like, to be able to go play stages where you do have like your sound guy and you do have your own wedge and you do, and it does sound good and you can dial it. You know what I mean? Like all that stuff. I mean, that's the shit that makes you appreciate what you've managed to build, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, one of my whole things is I as much as, you know, bluegrass is traditional music and everything, like when I'm writing like original music or whatever, it's like there is no boundaries or whatever. So, you know, I can add effects or whatever. Like I got some wacky shit going on with my guitar I should tell you about. It's pretty
cool. Oh, yeah, hit me.
That I did recently. But I guess what I'm saying is like, you know, there's no boundaries in it. So just because I'm a bluegrass guy and I grew up learning how to play bluegrass and that's what I really love and care about and stuff, like whenever I write my own music, sometimes the other elements kind of slip in, like being in the metal bands or, you know, the Hendrix or Zeppelin stuff, the Beatles shit that I've always geeked out on or whatever. Nowadays, the Dead's probably seeping into my live shows a bunch because, like, you know, we get off on these big jams and just go for, you know, 20, 30 minutes or whatever. And it's fun as hell.
Hey, you know, it's sort of tied into all this. I saw you had that guitar there that you were picking when we first started. Can you show me, like, what's your go-to shreddy spaghetti bluegrass lick? Like, what's a good, like, jump-off point for people out there? Show it to me slow, too, so I can pick it up.
I mean, something really simple that I'll do is if I'm playing in C.
I'm an old old man, Billy. Slow it down, for Christ's right. sake.
That was up to speed. So, you okay. know, if I'm in C.
Yeah.
There's also, let's see, there's this kind of neat one. Up to speed, it's like a...
Ooh, nice. Do that one nice and slow. Yeah. You know, all this begs the question, man. When are you doing the Billy Strings instructional YouTube series?
I suck at teaching because I don't even know what the fuck I'm doing. I don't. And it's just... Yeah,
you may not know the theory names for everything, but I'm going to push back on it. I think you know what you're doing very well.
Yeah.
It's funny because I remember the first time you came onto my radar was a couple of years ago. I saw you on that TV show where you're playing in a cave.
Yeah, the underground.
And I was like, who the fuck is this motherfucker? And how have I never heard of him? He's like 12 years old. He rips.
Hell yeah, dude. Well, that's cool, man. The first time I ever heard of the Foo Fighters out, you know, that was a long time back. I remember it was in the age of CDs, of course. Everybody yeah. had CDs. My mom had a CD player in a car. She had this big black book full of fucking CDs. And when I was a little kid, I got a CD, Walkman or whatever it wasn't a Walkman. It was like the ripoff version.
Right.
But I got a portable CD player for Christmas. And I got Dark Side of the Moon and this Johnny Winter record. And that's what I listened to going back and forth to school every time I walked to school for like a year or two, man. Just those two records. I listened to the Dark Side of the Moon so much. But I remember she had that Foo Fighters CD in there too, because it just always stood out, the double F's. It was like
a red nice.
CD. Yeah. And that was back then, like in the days of music videos. I mean, yeah. that I don't remember when that would have been, whether that was like before you joined or after, but I mean,
I joined after that record. I'm sad to say. I joined in 99.
Yeah. Well, shit. I mean, 99. That might have been around the time that I'm thinking of, at least, but, you know, I just remember the music videos were always so good. I remember, like, loving Foo Fighter music videos and all the music videos back then, for that matter.
Yeah.
Like, whatever happened to that?
I think YouTube happened to it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny. I think about that all the time. You know, I mean, I was, you know, I don't know, 10 years old or right around there, 10, 11, 12, something like that, when we first got MTV when I was a little kid. And I just spent my whole, you know, from that point on for the next whatever, 10, 15 years, the first thing I would turn on when I was a kid or a young adult or whatever was MTV for years. Yeah. Just like that was the thing. I mean, when's the last time you turned on? I don't even know if MTV still exists anymore. You know what I mean? Or like, I don't know, like.
Well, yeah, now it's like gone. it's probably like some like, folks like renovating houses or some shit.
Exactly. It all went reality TV. It's sad. Sad statement of, you know, our industry. Well, hey, man, this was a lot of fun. I really appreciate it. Thanks for being so generous with your time. And it's great talking to you, buddy.
Yeah, man. Thank you. I appreciate, you know, you having me on the show.
Yeah, man. Well, hopefully I'll get to come see you live sometime, you know, in the not too distant future.
Yeah, let me know, man. If we ever get back to doing our thing, just give me a holler and we'll throw you on the list or whatever.
Awesome, buddy. Take care.
Sweet, dude. Thank you.
Be well. Yeah, that was Billy Strings on Walking the Floor. Make sure you get on over to walkingthefloor.com, where I'll put some links up to some of the things that we talked about today, and you can check out where he's at and what he's doing. And that's it for this week, boys and girls. We'll see you in 2 weeks.
Adios, amigos.
This old boat is taking water. It won't be long.